There's one thing in the Brett Kavanaugh hearings that we at The Takeaway keep thinking about.
My friends and I, boys and girls, yes, we drank beer. I liked beer, still like beer. Sometimes probably had too many beers, and sometimes other people had too many beers. We liked beer.
During last week's Senate hearings, the Supreme Court nominee ducked and dodged questions about his drinking habits. Some of the details that emerged from the hearings of parties and kegs and drinking to the point of blacking out, they're familiar to many of us. Either we've been there or we know people who've been there. And we're surrounded by mostly positive messages about alcohol everywhere we go. It's in our music.
Drinking again.
And the beer I had for breakfast wasn't bad.
What's your name? Let me talk to you. Let me buy you a drink.
And it's in our movies and TV.
You're gonna bring us two absolute martinis. You know how I like them, straight up.
Shaken, not stirred.
Is there alcohol in this?
Why do you want a little bit? Because if you're gonna drink, I'd rather you do it in the house.
And I am just 3 days away from the biggest drinking binge in history.
To alcohol, the cause of and solution to all of life's problems.
So let's be honest, America. Do we have a drinking problem?
Hi, this is Joseph from Worcester, originally from Cannes, France. The U.S. drinking is a little out of control. I grew up in France, and wine and beer were childhood beverages. When I moved back to New England to go to high school, drinking was a big thing. I had already been to nightclubs. It was not a big deal for me to drink. Beer and wine are not really considered alcoholic beverages for minors in Europe. They should consider that here.
Hi, I'm Ursula from St. Louis. I think casual drinking culture is so pervasive, especially here where I live. I do drink, but not very often, and it seems like there are so few social outlets that don't involve alcohol. It makes it hard to abstain when one needs to or wants to.
Hi, I'm Nicholas from Westfield, Massachusetts. Education about appropriate alcohol consumption is largely a family responsibility. There is a responsible way to consume alcohol. People do need to be taught, not necessarily in school, but certainly they need to be encouraged by family to learn what to do and how to be responsible.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Tanzina Vega. Today, alcohol in America. Christina Mayer is an assistant professor at the University of Pittsburgh Graduate School of Public Health, and Gabrielle Glazer is the author of Her Best Kept Secret, Why Women Drink and How They Can Regain Control. And Gabrielle says to understand modern party culture, we have to go back quite a bit.
Prohibition spawned a culture of binge drinking. There were booze cruises off the shores of every coastal state. People socialized for the first time, men and women socialized together in speakeasies. And the point of drinking during Prohibition was to drink as much as you possibly could because you might be raided by the feds. So actually, ironically, Prohibition spawned a culture of binge drinking that has persisted for 100 years.
Christina, when we look at this from a public health perspective, most of us, when we get our annual physicals, our doctors will ask us, how often do you drink? How much do you drink? For researchers, how do you look at how Americans drink?
That's a great question. So we look at several different pieces. The first is actually just frequency of drinking and who is a drinker or is not a drinker. So we know that about 70% of American adults are past year drinkers. So the majority of Americans do drink. The next question would be sort of how frequently do you drink? Do you drink once a week or every single day, only on weekends? And then finally, there's the question of heavy drinking. So you've already referred to binge drinking, which is defined as 4 or more drinks for a woman and 5 or more drinks per man in a given drinking episode in a given day. And that sort of is the gold standard for what we consider to be heavy drinking or binge drinking. But we also do know that many Americans typically only consume one drink, sometimes two drinks. And there are increased risks for people drinking if you typically only have one drink and you consume 3 drinks on one given occasion. So this sort of magic number of binge drinking works at some sort of a population average, which is what we look at in public health. But there are risks associated with lower levels of drinking potentially as well.
Who is drinking the most, Christina? Do we have a sense of who is consuming the most alcohol in the United States, particularly when it comes to heavy drinking?
Yes, unsurprisingly, it's those under age 25 in the United States. So college-aged populations, those in college but also, you know, non-college attending young adults drink the most. Although rates don't decline that much, we see a lot of people in the age range of 45 to 65. There are a lot of alcohol consumers, although probably only about 15 to 20% of those in that 45 to 65-year-old age range are binge drinkers or heavy episodic drinkers with any sort of frequency. The heavy and binge drinking we often see in college-age populations.
Gabrielle, I'm wondering, this was something that we were thinking about in terms of culture, in American culture. We know, as we all just said here, college students have a proclivity for binge drinking, frat parties on college campuses. What role does gender play in all of this?
We know today on college campuses, the numbers of men and women are roughly equal in terms of actual numbers, physical numbers. But activities remain defined by male culture. Fraternity parties, football games, tailgate parties, pre-gaming, drinking to get drunk has become something that drinking researchers have studied since the 1980s. There are surveys that started taking place in the early 1980s, and they lasted for about 20 years, I think up till 2002. College students were actually reporting, oh, I'm drinking on an empty stomach, and more women were doing this than men. I'm drinking shots. I'm doing this intentionally. I want to get drunk. This is my object. It's not to socialize and have a good time and just hang out and have a couple of drinks with my friends. It's literally the object is to get obliterated.
I'd be curious, Christina, also, if you saw the hearing and you saw the exchanges between Brett Kavanaugh and the senators who were questioning him. When this issue came up, what was your reaction to Kavanaugh's sort of defense of his drinking or defense of the questioning?
Yeah, so we know that people with more sort of socioeconomic and other resources are sort of able to experience higher levels of binge drinking and experience fewer consequences and sort of see more of the positive attributes of drinking. And so, you know, quite frankly, it didn't surprise me that this is how he portrayed his drinking experiences. Many Americans, you know, many people look back fondly on their college years and their high school years of heavy binge drinking, heavy episodic drinking, without sort of realizing that there are, you know, hundreds of thousands of Americans who are not so lucky and cannot sort of drink at those levels and continue, you know, they end up developing either alcohol use disorders or experience, you know, legal social consequences that are really important. So both from my own experience, you know, as someone who went to high school and college, as well as what I've seen from the research, it didn't surprise me that someone with Kavanaugh's social stature sort of sees drinking and understands drinking in the way that he does.
Yeah. And I think about President Trump, who recently, you know, drove the point home that he does not drink at all. And there are reasons why the president doesn't drink. He's had alcoholism in his own family. What about the 30-some-odd percent of Americans who don't drink, Christina? I'm curious, what do you do if you're one of those people who doesn't want to drink, doesn't choose to drink? Are you disconnected from the social contract, from the social fabric if you don't? I found it quite difficult if, you know, not drinking and then trying to engage socially.
You know, that's not an area of research that I study myself, but from what I've observed in talking to people who are non-drinkers, absolutely, you know, for example, even thinking about, you know, workplaces that I've been a part of in the past, happy hour, going out for drinks with friends afterwards is also a place where sort of business deals are done or work gets done as well. It's an important sort of form of socialization. And I think that some non-drinkers are quite comfortable around people who are consuming alcohol, but it's very difficult for some people, particularly those who have potentially had an alcohol use disorder in their own past. The context and being in an environment like a bar environment can be a difficult thing to do. So I think there is a lot of, you know, in American culture, a lot of this is built around, you know, drinking environments and drinking expectations. And one thing we do know is that when you drink and when you go out to these contexts, you know, if you're drinking in a bar with friends, you tend to really drink to the level of those around you. So we know even sort of amongst drinkers that there's this sort of social contagion, this effect that if I typically have one drink, but I'm going out to happy hour with colleagues and we, you know, my friends are, or my coworkers are consuming 2 to 3 drinks, I probably will drink more than I would otherwise. So I think that, you know, non-drinkers also feel that social contagion, that sort of influence of drinking. And I imagine that's quite difficult.
So do we have a problem, Gabrielle?
Oh, I believe we do. 88,000 people, according to the CDC, die every year from alcohol overuse. Cirrhosis deaths between 2000 and 2015, after having declined for 3 decades straight, rose 21% in men aged 45 and 64, and alarmingly 57% among women.
Wow. Christina, do we have a problem?
Absolutely. I think that, you know, you look at deaths and that there are more alcohol attributable deaths than, you know, any, related to any other substance. And it's one of sort of the leading causes of preventable death in this country. And, you know, beyond just looking at mortality, the morbidity, the impact on our society is just massive. Everything from, you know, physiological problems, feeling hungover, not being able to go to work the next day, to social consequences, feeling shame, getting in trouble in the workplace, legal problems, as well as, of course, so this is in the media today, and we're talking about, you know, sexual assault, sexual violence, there are, you know, intimate partner violence. Some of my research focuses on the link between IPV and alcohol. So I think if we take a broader look at the impacts of alcohol in the United States and worldwide, it's sort of, you know, it's, there's no way you could say that we do not have a problem with alcohol.
And from each of you, any thoughts on how we can get better?
I think we need to look at countries in which, and cultures in which, moderation is really modeled very, very well. We don't have a culture of moderation in this country for anything.
Christina?
So a lot of my research focuses on sort of what I call environmental prevention. So it's thinking about how we can actually change the contexts in which we drink. And these are, you know, the social contexts as well as some physical aspects of the places where people drink. So I think if we think about prevention and as well as secondary prevention, so prevention of heavy drinking in the first place, as well as sort of prevention of these consequences related to alcohol, so we don't sort of put all the pressure just on the individual that, you know, you're responsible for your own drinking and you need to go seek treatment and help if you have a problem with drinking. I think that we can sort of think of it in a broader context and try to think what we can do as a culture and as a country to prevent these problems in the first place. And I think there are a number of avenues that we could potentially explore to help reduce alcohol problems at a population level.
Gabrielle Glazer is the author of Her Best Kept Secret, Why Women Drink and How They Can Regain Control. And Christina Mayer is the Assistant Professor of Behavior and Community Health Sciences at the University of Pittsburgh Graduate School of Public Health. Thank you both for joining us.
Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Hi, this is Christy calling from Tyler, Texas, and I guess I'd just love to see the use of alcohol framed in a more honest way. It won't make you beautiful, sexy, popular, or rich. It isn't the devil, but it can sure cause a lot of heartache and pain.
How did you get home? I don't remember. How'd you get there? I don't remember. Where is the place? I don't remember. How many years ago was it? I don't know. I don't know. I don't know. I don't know.
The president of the United States held a rally last night in Mississippi. During one portion of the hour-plus-long speech, he made light of Dr. Christine Blasey Ford, who's accused Brett Kavanaugh of sexually assaulting her 36 years ago while they were both in high school.
What is the strongest memory you have? Strongest memory of the incident? Something that you cannot forget? Take whatever time you need.
Indelible in the hippocampus is the laughter, the uproarious laughter between the two, and they're having fun at my expense.
Meanwhile, Dr. Ford says she hasn't been interviewed by the FBI as part of the investigation spurred by the Senate confirmation process. The Republicans' self-imposed deadline for the investigation is Friday. President Trump says he's a self-made man, But according to the New York Times, by the time he was three, Trump was earning $200,000 a year in today's dollars from his father's wealth and real estate empire. By the time he was eight, he was a millionaire. In total, the president received $413 million from his father's real estate empire. That's according to a scathing investigation by the New York Times, one of the longest pieces ever published by the paper. The investigation was based on more than 100,000 pages of documents. It charted the financial history of the Trump family business and the extent to which Donald Trump profited off of the transfer of wealth from his father, Fred Trump. The report detailed signs of tax evasion and very likely tax fraud involving sham corporations, undervalued real estate holdings, and schemes to avoid inheritance taxes. In total, $1 billion, that's billion with a B, dollars in wealth was transferred from the Trump parents to the Trump children. And instead of paying 55% of tax on those funds, the Times investigation found the Trumps paid just 5% tax. That's basically the equivalent of about $500 million in taxes that went unpaid. Jenny Johnson Ware is a criminal tax attorney and partner at Johnson Moore in Chicago, and she joins me now. Jenny, thanks for being with The Takeaway.
Thank you so much for having me.
So lots to unpack here, but let's start with your broad assessment. Is what the New York Times found fraud?
There are certainly parts of this that are fraud. There are parts of it that are tax avoidance or tax minimization that is perfectly well within the confines of the law. And then there are parts of that very significantly cross the line.
And we, of course, should mention that the president's lawyer told the New York Times that the allegation of tax fraud and evasions were, quote, 100% false and highly defamatory. Despite that, the Times found 295 distinct streams of revenue created by Fred Trump to help transfer this money to his son, Donald Trump, which is, quite frankly, pretty incredible. And one of the ways that they did that was by creating a company called All County Building Supply and Maintenance, and they used that company to supposedly buy things like cleaning supplies. But in the Times investigation, they found that basically it was a shell company. It was a company on paper, and they would mark up the cost of products as a way of transferring the money as untaxed gifts. Is that tax fraud?
I believe that it is, based on my review of the allegations in the Times article. If those facts are true, this is tax fraud. And one of the key concepts in tax law is that the economic substance needs to match what you put on paper and what you report to the IRS. And this company had no economic substance. It was merely a way of funneling gifts from the president's father to the president and his siblings.
One of the other things we mentioned at the top is that the Trumps also undervalued their real estate properties. And according to this investigation in the New York Times, Fred Trump's 1995 gift tax return, he claimed that 25 apartment complexes he owned were valued at $41.4 million. But the New York Times says the bank value was actually near $900 million. What about that? Is it clear that that's tax fraud?
It's not as clear because you need to understand the way that valuations occur and the kinds of discounting that is actually appropriate and normal when looking at a minority interest in a company. So you start with a value. And if that value is wrong, then everything following it is wrong. And in this case, it looks like that value was probably wrong. But it's not as clear cut because we don't have the competing valuations done by another expert as of the same approximate date. We're looking at things that happened years after, and things do change over the course of time. I would say that those valuations are highly likely to be wrong, but whether and subject to civil penalties, whether that amounts to fraud or not is more questionable.
I guess the question that this is sort of all coming from our tax code in the United States, which I think, I want to warn our listeners, don't let your eyes glaze over when I say tax code. Who does the tax code favor? I mean, is it something that wealthier families and wealthier Americans are more savvy about and know how to get their way around these types of loopholes?
Yeah, I think wealthy Americans are more savvy, but I also think they need to be. I think an important thing to remember here is that the estate tax only applies to the wealthiest individuals and families. It only kicks in now this year if when you die, you have more than $11 million. So it's not like these people are avoiding a tax that is generally applicable to the rest of the population, like when they are avoiding income tax and other people are paying their fair share of income tax. In estate tax, you know, it's a creation of Congress that only applies to the wealthy. And then there are other creations of Congress that minimize the amount those same people have to pay. And if you follow the rules, then you're abiding by the law. The problem here is that the rules were not really followed.
Well, and it feels like they weren't followed, but it also, I think for a lot of Americans, I think there's a sense of frustration among those of us who pay our taxes and don't, you know, find these loopholes and are paying a significant amount of our income in taxes versus the wealthy who kind of seem to be able to get around this.
I think that's more of a valid complaint with income tax. With estate tax, none of the rest of us pay estate tax.
Do the wealthy pay estate tax?
Yes, significant portions of it. And you know, sometimes they can minimize the amount that they have to pay.
Mm-hmm. And what is that? What, you know, is that normal behavior of the ultra wealthy in this country?
Minimizing the amount of estate tax is absolutely normal behavior. Committing fraud to do it is not normal behavior.
So how do we distinguish the two?
You have to look at the amounts and whether the violation of the law is willful. And, you know, the IRS has a whole set of penalties that they use to apply based on how undervalued the properties were in the estate tax returns.
Jenny Johnson Ware is a criminal tax attorney and partner at Johnson Moore in Chicago. Jenny, thanks for being with The Takeaway.
Thank you.
Today's podcast is sponsored by Babbel. People around the world are learning new languages with the Babbel Language Learning app. Learn Spanish, French, Italian, German, Russian, Swedish, and more with Babbel's 10 to 15 minute lessons. You'll learn through interactive dialogues, speech recognition, and fun trainers and quizzes. And in a few short weeks, you can be speaking a new language with confidence. And Babbel is available as an app or online. And right now, you can try Babbel for free. Go to Babbel.com and download the app and try it for free. That's right, Babbel, Babbel.com, or download the app to try it for free, Babbel.com.
Survivors in Palu, Indonesia, are growing more desperate in the aftermath of a massive earthquake and tsunami. Last Friday, a 7.5 magnitude earthquake struck just off the coast of the island of Sulawesi, setting off a tsunami that devoured the city of Palu. As of Wednesday morning, more than 1,400 people have been confirmed dead. Reports say that police are guarding shops against those desperate for food and resources. Joining us to talk about the situation on the ground is Rebecca Henschke, Indonesia editor for the BBC, who is in Palu.
The city still has no power, so that is of major concern. Most people here get their clean drinking water through pumps into underground water supplies. So with the power out, it means people have very little access to clean drinking water. A lot of the rivers around here have been polluted with mud, as there were major mudslides triggered by the earthquake. So people are desperate for that. There's also a shortage in the city now of petrol, which means people having difficulty getting around, getting out of the city to somewhere else, and also with tampering search and rescue efforts. Also, food is in short supply as well.
Has the Indonesian government been able to coordinate what they need in order to help the survivors on the island of Sulawesi?
Well, President Joko Widodo has visited the area today, and he's promising to speed up the aid operation here. People are very frustrated about the slow pace of aid. The Indonesian military was deployed early, and today the only airport in Palu has reopened. The runway was badly damaged in the quake. But the opening up today of that airport means that there have been cargo planes that have been able to land, carrying that much-needed fresh water, food, and fuel. But there's lots of areas outside of Palu, in Donggala and beyond, that no aid has reached. Today at Palu Airport, I met one lady who had walked with her family of four young children for 10 hours through the mountains from one of these remote villages. she said after days waiting for help to arrive, she knew she needed to do something, and that's why they made that long journey on foot to get some kind of help. And she gulped down some water and some bread at the airport, the first drink that they'd had for a couple of days.
Is there enough international aid arriving right now?
Well, that has also been slow, given the problems accessing this area. And President Joko Widodo said today that it could be a matter of weeks before the power supply is restored to these areas.
Now, there are also Indonesians outside of the country, here in the United States and abroad, who are probably wondering how, if any, way they can help recovery efforts on the ground. Have you been able to assess the best way to do that so far?
Well, people have been sending aid in the form of food and clothes in huge measures, and that's been sitting in warehouses in Jakarta. A lot of that is difficult to get into this area. I would suggest finding out which groups they think are going to operate here effectively and sending cash that then can be accessed by aid workers on the ground here and used to buy resources here or in towns outside of Palu.
Rebecca Henschke is on the ground in Palu, Indonesia for the BBC. Rebecca, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
We now turn to an aid organization to see how they are coordinating their assistance efforts to Indonesia from the United States. Kate Deschino is Vice President of Emergency Programs for AmeriCares, a humanitarian organization that provides health resources to disaster zones. Kate, thanks for joining The Takeaway.
Thank you, Tanzina.
So where are you and the organization in the process right now in sending whatever needs to be sent to Indonesia?
AmeriCares response teams are on the ground in Palu, and what they're seeing are incredibly difficult situations. They're seeing people who have just lost everything, their loved ones, their homes. They're operating without electricity, communications, and limited gasoline. And many are just simply worried about staying safe after just continued aftershocks, even just as early as this morning.
When AmeriCares gets on the ground in a situation like this that's so hectic and so intense, how do you evaluate what's needed? Where do you even begin?
We've been doing this for a long time, and really what is important is listening to the needs and coordinating with other response agencies and local officials. And so one of the things that AmeriCares looks for is meeting the immediate health needs. And so one of the ways that we can look at that is making sure that health workers have the medicines and medical supplies that they need, making sure that they're able to operate. If needed, AmeriCares is prepared to send medical professionals and rehabilitate health facilities, but really looking at, for the many displaced, what are the basic things that they need? Many are forced to leave their homes quickly, and basic hygiene items are what families really need in these emergency shelters.
We've seen, and sadly, we're becoming more accustomed to these major natural disasters. You were previously in Indonesia providing assistance for another earthquake in August. We've seen the stories even here in the United States of hurricane victims. We've been watching Post Maria in Puerto Rico. And I think what all these stories are showing us is that there are real challenges in not just getting aid, but distributing it and accessing the folks that need it. What are you seeing on the ground now?
That's right, Tanzina. For people affected, aid is just never fast enough. And especially in places where airports are closed and roads are blocked and fuel is in limited supply. And it's really not unheard of for the first wave of aid to take a few days. But again, we've been doing this for a long time and we're prepared to go to great extents. So similar to our responses in Nepal after the earthquake or in Philippines or recently, as you mentioned, in Puerto Rico, we'll do whatever it takes to get the aid there. We've chartered planes, we've used boats, we've operated our own warehouses and ground logistics. And really, we do whatever we can to get the right aid to the right people at the right time and really focused on health.
And when we think about things like this, I recall it, when we're thinking about Puerto Rico and Hurricane Maria, there were some logistical challenges in getting the aid to the folks who needed it on the island, partly because of some obscure laws that prevented things from being moved in a timely manner. Are there any legal issues that you all are looking at when it comes to transporting medicine and health resources to other countries, particularly right now with Indonesia?
every country has different requirements for aid, and we have a team of experts that understand the complexities of what to send and how to send it. And so, similar to what we did after the Lombok earthquake, we're working and coordinating with government officials, understanding what we can do to reopen health facilities and get aid to those who need it.
Are you hearing from Indonesians in the United States who are trying to either locate loved ones or send aid?
The best way that people can support right now is to make financial contributions to trusted aid organizations. The organizations that are on the ground doing the work and are closest to it know best what's needed, and the situation continues to change rapidly. And so trusting those organizations to deliver aid in the moment is really what is best.
Kate Duschino is the Vice President of Emergency Response for AmeriCares. Kate, thanks so much for being with The Takeaway.
Thank you.
Today, we bring you one more story on the transition to life after prison. Every Thursday night in Hamilton Heights, Manhattan, a lively meeting gathers. Music plays and people chat as they find seats in a large room overlooking the Hudson River. This is the Fortune Society here in New York City, an organization that works with the formerly incarcerated to ease their transition. And on a recent Thursday, one theme emerged: the fear of doing anything that might get you sent back to prison.
My job that I have is very stressful. Yes, my chef talks very down and degrading. But if I let that get next to me, the first thing he's going to do, if I raise my hand to him, he's going to call the cops on me, and I'm going to lose everything I work for, including my Section 8. I'm going to lose everything.
A young man also stood up, 19 years old. He, too, was worried about how his behavior could land him back in trouble.
I'm really sorry for what I did today. I broke some property and all that, and an incident happened. But basically, I just want to say I'm sorry, whatever, because I'm working on myself. I'm trying to change myself, trying to become a better man, because I know I still got, like, imperfections. I know I still got my anger that I had to work on.
The community of formerly incarcerated men and women rallied around this teenager with stories of fighting their own demons to keep from going backwards.
Even after all the time you've been out, you still get those feelings, right? Because sometimes people think, oh, once I've got this thing figured out, I'm never going to feel that again. I'm never going to. You still feel it, but you manage it differently.
Think about these things in your perspective. Do you want to go back? Preset to the central booking. Back to, you don't want to do that no more. So at 19, think about this problem. Remember, there are some people who are going to hear you when you're silent and who are going to see you when you think you're invisible. Mm-hmm.
Keeping people from going back to prison after they get out has long been a way to measure success in the American criminal justice system. Bruce Western is a professor of sociology at Columbia University and co-director of the Columbia University Justice Lab. Bruce, thanks for being with us.
Oh, thanks for having me.
So how likely is it that someone will return to prison in the United States?
After about 3 years, the statistics show that about half the people coming out will return to custody.
And what is there a driving force for that recidivism?
It's a lot of different things. It's not just a return to criminal behavior. In the study I was doing in Boston, talking to people coming out of state prison in Massachusetts, the biggest predictor of return to custody was relapse to addiction. That took many different forms. Sometimes people were committing new crimes to support their habits. Sometimes they were in the middle of a bender and getting in fights and other conflicts. Sometimes they were violating the conditions of their parole and failing a drug test. So a big piece of this, I think, is honestly a public health crisis among people with struggling with addiction.
And, you know, our producer, Alexandra, was out at meeting with men who had come out of prison after many, many, many years. And there is this recurring theme of fear of going back. Do you find that in your research, that there is a fear that these folks who are coming out of prison are very aware of their own likelihood of relapsing or going back?
Yeah. And I think part of that fear is the stress of incarceration that people often reported to us, and people who are struggling with addiction or mental health problems found prison very, very stressful. On the outside, I think people were exhibiting symptoms of post-traumatic stress. And when people express fear about going back, the post-traumatic stress they're experiencing is a significant part of that fear.
What exactly, then, are we measuring when we analyze recidivism in the United States?
That is a great question. In many cases, I think it's the key question in a lot of ways because we're overwhelmingly focused on recidivism. But I think we know that part of it is due to failures of our health system for people who are in poor health. A lot of people coming out are on parole, and parole these days is really a surveillance bureaucracy. And
as opposed to a rehabilitative process.
Exactly. And, you know, historically, parole was conceived to help people return to society, find their place in a community after incarceration. It's really become very much a law enforcement function. It's parole officers spend a lot of their time monitoring compliance with the conditions of community release. And failing a drug test, missing appointments can land you back in prison.
You have a different way of looking at recidivism. Desistance?
Yeah.
And tell us what that is.
So criminologists talk about recidivism, offending again after you've committed crime or after you've been released from prison. They also talk about desistance, and desistance means permanently refraining from crime. And I think the focus on desistance shifts how we think about the response to the problem of crime and how we should think about people who are returning home after incarceration. And the objective when we focus on desistance is to socially integrate people back into communities, try and help them find a place for them in their families, in the labor market, in the neighborhoods in which they live. The problem of recidivism takes a perspective of society. What harm might someone returning home from prison cause to the rest of us? The perspective on desistance asks, how can we find a place in society for someone who has been separated from it by incarceration? A lot of the answers to the problem of reentry are not going to be found with criminal justice authorities. They're going to be found outside of the criminal justice system with departments of health and housing and education and in the resources of communities. I think there's an appetite for that conversation. There's a growing understanding that this massive experiment in mass incarceration has not been successful. It's been very, very expensive, and it's been very damaging for our most disadvantaged communities.
What are some things that help desistance?
One line of research says there are really two things that are fundamentally important. One is your intimate family relationships are really important for getting on a path in which your life becomes predictable and secure. And so marriage has been highly correlated with desistance from crime. The second thing is stable employment. In both of these things, marriage and stable employment, you've got a network of people around you who are helping to routinize daily life, make it more predictable. You've got people who are keeping an eye on you in different ways.
We have talked about the likelihood of finding employment after incarceration. There is a really long tail of post-incarceration challenges for a lot of folks. How does that impact reentry or desistance in this case?
Yeah, it's very challenging. The stigma of a criminal record has big negative effects on the job market. There's a race dimension to this, where the stigma of a criminal record, the evidence shows, is more serious for African Americans after incarceration than for whites. And you see this in the data. Unemployment rates are higher, wages are lower for formerly incarcerated black men compared to formerly incarcerated white men.
At a policy level, we've in the past, we've talked about Ban the Box, for example, to help remove one of the barriers that formerly incarcerated people have when trying to find work. Where are we today when it comes to policy? That story seems to have not, you know, obviously we have many other things we're dealing with in the United States right now, but I haven't heard a lot about policy and its impact today. Where are we?
Great question. Most of the focus right now, interestingly, I think, is on sentencing and trying to shrink the system rather than remedy the negative effects of the system. So in that sense, I think we're further along. I think that's a more productive conversation. But the truth is we need to invest in people who have been disinvested in their whole lives.
How do you convince an administration, any administration, to do that, but particularly one now that doesn't seem to have a focus on that community?
I think we have to think of community investments as public safety strategies. This is what it is to make a community safer. And we've found incredible political appetite for shoveling money into the prison system for years and years and years. We're spending $80 billion on our prisons every year. It costs over $200,000 to incarcerate someone for a year at Rikers Island. So I think that is the challenge, right? How do we take that money that's spent on our prisons and jails and redirect it to invest in communities? This is still about public safety. This is still about making our community safer, but it's a much more positive way to do it.
Bruce Western is a professor of sociology at Columbia University and the co-director of the Columbia University Justice Lab. Bruce, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks, Tanzina.
There are all sorts of conversations that parents have with their kids. But talks like these about paying for college aren't always at the top of the list.
What if I want to go to a school that costs a lot of money?
I don't know that it's the greatest idea. If you got a bunch of money to do that, then yeah, do it. But if that would require you to be saddled with a bunch of debt, no, I would advise against it. And I can't go into more debt for it either.
That's Julie Smith talking to her son Perry back when he was a 15-year-old high school sophomore. Together, they've been working through all sorts of issues about preparing for college.
I don't feel ready at all. I need like another 10 years.
To get a job or to go to school?
go to college.
I mean, it might surprise you to know that it's equally scary for me, and maybe even more so.
I think it's more scary for me, because...
Maybe, but...
You've experienced it. I haven't.
I know, and I don't think I was as scared to go to college as I am to send my children to college.
Julie Smith and her son Perry are just two of the voices featured in a new project by financial literacy advocate and author Beth Kobliner. It's called We Need to Talk College, and the project is timed to coincide with the opening of the federal financial student aid application process, known affectionately to many of us as FAFSA. Beth, welcome to The Takeaway.
It's so good to be here. Thank you.
I got warm and fuzzy just thinking about the FAFSA. remembering how simple it was and
what a
joy it was to fill that out. So your project is encouraging parents to talk to kids about paying for college. And I have a lot of thoughts about this, but okay. I want to know, what should they be talking about?
Right. Well, the first thing you really want to do is start talking about why college is still beneficial. Maybe your kids have been hearing stories of indebtedness and they're frightened about the idea of even applying for college. Maybe they're worried about what effect it'll have on you as their parent.
Do you think it's worth it? Is it still
worth
it? It's
absolutely worth it. I mean, I was on a book tour and I like to call it the Mark Zuckerberg effect, because all these parents are like, well, he didn't finish college. Can't my kid not go? And the truth is, and I looked into the research, and studies show that those who graduate from college earn on average $1 million more than people who don't go to college. And no matter how you slice it, even if you factor in, you know, student debt, it's still advantageous to go to college. But you have to be careful to pick the right school and to pay for it in the right way. And that's so difficult for so many parents because it's such a ridiculously complicated system.
So I was, when I went to college, undergrad, I had partly paid for it through a scholarship,
mm-hmm.
and the rest of it was just me, you know, working.
Right.
My parents weren't able to give me anything. I'm sure there are people in that situation. What do they do if their parents are like, look, it's just not feasible?
Right. And I think more and more parents should feel comfortable saying, look, we're not going to take on debt for your college. You know, and we tried to save, but we don't have enough saved because it's really, really expensive. And I think that's a conversation that parents have to have with kids up front. Again, because, I mean, I know a lot of adults who have told me, yeah, I remember I applied to my dream school. I got in and my parents told me at the very end, oh, we can't afford it. And that, you know, it's better just to prepare up front. But I do think as a family, first of all, parents can get a sense of what they might be asked to pay for college by looking at each college that their kids might be interested in. Then this is early, like eighth grade, ninth grade. And just
so they should be looking that early.
Yes.
Okay.
Just to get a feel for what it'll cost. There are these things called the net price calculators that give you a sense. You have to fill out your income, your assets, all, but you will get a sense of what the colleges will expect you roughly to pay.
I wonder, is it that important too? I mean, I went to city and state school because that's what I could afford.
Right.
It was very clear that right. if I had gone, and I still came out with debt for my graduate degree, mm-hmm. so, you know, which took more than 10 years to pay off, regularly paying it off. So I wonder when young people say, or people who are about to go mm-hmm. to college say, I want to go to this school.
Right.
Right. And I keep thinking, but how are you going to pay for that school?
Exactly. And I think that's a really important thing to talk about. Like, what is it about this school? Oh, you really want a football team? Well, have you ever even seen a football game? Like, you know, just kind of really talking it through with kids. I think sometimes parents feel somewhat guilty, like, oh, I want my kid to have this, you know, this experience that they really want. But they often don't know what they're talking about.
Right.
So really going through the options. And generally speaking, you know, if you can get a good education at a local school, that is a wonderful opportunity. And even starting at a two-year community college. I think these are the kind of conversations we have to have now because it can get so ridiculously expensive so quickly for really not much of a good reason.
You feature conversations from families that you've talked to about the cost of college. And we heard from the Smiths in our opener, but right. I want you to tell me about the Guerra family. And what was it that resonated from you about them?
Well, they were so amazing because they were in a situation where the mom was really, they didn't have a lot of money, but she was really good about trying to save in the Florida prepaid plan. That's where they were from. And she started when her daughter was young and she thought, oh, this is great. She'll have some money. And then it turns out she didn't want to stay in Florida. And she got into Columbia University in New York. And she did get quite a bit of her need met, the, you know, financial need, because her parents filled out the financial aid form. And it was tricky because there was a point at which, you know, her sophomore year, then it's like, ooh, now I have to start taking on some debt.
I have a very vivid memory of we had to pay more. You guys weren't sure if you could afford it. And then you're like, oh, well, you know, if anything, like you have to just like transfer out and come back to Florida. And then like I remember crying, but I think that's just when I started taking out loans. That was the solution.
And she graduated with about $16,000, I think, in student loans, which in her case, she felt that looking at that equation, and she was very smart about it, it was worth it. But if that education cost her $60,000 in debt, would it be worth it? I don't think she would say it would have been.
What about another option or two other options? Delaying starting college, right?
Yeah.
And or working during that time to save right. up your own money, or working while you're in college. Are either of those options things that are on the table
right.
these days?
Honestly, I think that, you know, I know more kids are taking gaps years for a variety of reasons. It makes me personally a little nervous because what if you get in a job and you're sort of set on a track and you're like, oh, this is kind of fun earning my own money. And then you don't go back to school. And again, we know, you know, people who graduate from college earn on average $1 million more than those who don't. But absolutely working in school. We also know from research that kids who work fewer than 20 hours a week in college on an on-campus job, they have slightly higher GPAs than kids who don't work at all. So working and working in your summers, that's a great time to really stash it away. If you can get a job near home, live with your parents and use that time. I mean, I think of all those, like, you know, jobs I had over the summer and you
do. Mm-hmm.
And you try to save as much as you can. And I think that that's so important to have these conversations now so there are no horrible surprises down the road. But I think that, you know, look, I think that the vast majority of people get financial aid. I think the forms are annoying. The process is annoying. It is sort of this black hole. You don't know what's going to happen. But still, you want to fill out the FAFSA, prepare up in advance, and have the conversations up front so that you can get a better sense of where you're going. It's not a perfect process, but I tried in Let's Talk College to come up with ways for people to figure out, you know, how do you have these conversations? How do you apply to schools? How do you pay for it? And how do you choose?
Beth, thanks again for joining us.
It was great to be here. Thank you.
Beth Kobliner is a financial literacy advocate and the author of Make Your Kid a Money Genius, Even If You're Not. You can find a link to her new project, We Need to Talk College, at thetakeaway.org.
My name is Christine. I'm from Akron, Ohio. I am a single mom with two kids in college. Loans are a necessity, even with grants and scholarships. We only take government loans, preferring just the subsidized if possible. Of course, they don't want to hear how I graduated in 1984 with $3,200 in loans and paid for the rest by working in the summer. This is not possible now.
My name is Maureen Kingsley, and I'm calling from El Segundo, California. My 12 and 9-year-old kids already know that if they go to college, the expectation is that they will do work study of some kind to help pay for it. We also watch their 529s grow, albeit slowly, and talk about scholarships. I'm actually pretty panicked about how on earth we'll afford college, but I try not to let the kids see that.
Hi, my name is Mary, and I'm calling from Westchester. We started planning for college for our children when they were born. It was very challenging at times, and many times throughout their lives, when we opted to forgo a vacation, we would explain to our kids that we did it so that they would eventually have college money. Now we have a college junior and a high school senior. Our conversations about paying for college have largely been celebratory because we were prepared.
Hi, this is John from Buffalo. I spoke to my daughter about qualifying for elite schools because the Ivy League schools and a few of the other elite schools in this country now give financial aid based on need. And I knew that if she could qualify for one of those schools, she would be all set. In fact, she is. She attends Duke University. All of her expenses are paid because our family income is below $60,000.
Hi, my name's Damani. I'm calling from Brooklyn. My kid's only 6 years old, but we talk about scholarships often and early. We take him to every graduation of any family member he has, and we hope that that instills the confidence that he needs to go for those scholarships and those grants.
Your calls on the struggles of paying for college, please join us in the conversation on The Takeaway's Facebook page or tweet us at The Takeaway. That's our show for today. Thank you so much for listening. I'm Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway. See you tomorrow.